everyone. Welcome to a special Your Amigos podcast. Tom and I here with Tian Zhang from UT Southwestern, and we're going to do a recap of the recent IKCS, the Kidney Cancer Association annual meeting, which was held right here in Nashville, I guess Friday and Saturday, just a couple days ago. So Tian, welcome. I know you have spent a lot of time in Nashville recently. We're grateful. You were involved in the organizing committee, and I know it's a lot of work. So first of all, congrats on a great conference. I thought we'd maybe start with, there were some new things done this year that I hadn't seen done before. So maybe, you know, take us through those highlights and then we can talk about the rest of the conference from there.
Sure. Well, first, thanks so much, Brian and Tom, for highlighting the International Kidney Cancer Symposium. As you know, is a meeting put on by the Kidney Cancer Association each year, and I was very grateful to be part of it. And I co-chaired the planning committee with Phil Perrazio. And as you say, we had more than 400 participants, and we were really excited to have hosted the conference. A couple of cool highlights that we did this year that we hadn't done before. One was really featuring our patients' voices. We had patients and also affiliate programs open up each of the segments, each of the panels, and tell their stories, and really putting front and center the patient's journey and our work, right? That we find our work meaningful in kidney cancer because we do it for our patients. The second thing that we did was really highlight the story of belzutifan from drug discovery to its regulatory approvals recently. So that was a really exciting panel. And then we had a keynote from Dr. Peter Emby, who is a VP of research and innovation at Vanderbilt, where you are, Brian. He talked to us about artificial intelligence applications in health systems, and in particular, thoughts about how we can integrate in kidney cancer. So those were the highlights. We had more than 80 research abstracts, actually. This was a record-breaking year, and including two late-breaking ones. So that was also really exciting.
So Tian, talk maybe first about the AI keynote discussion that Peter did. I think it's something that we talk about. I'm not particularly educated about it, but what were the take-homes? I mean, where do we think we're going? Are we going to get there quickly? Is that going to change the way we think about clinical research and patient care in the near future?
Sure. His Dr. Emby's talk was really patient focused. So he started this the talk with his journey with pheochromocytoma and how the different electronic health systems are collecting a lot of data about people, but we need to be smarter to integrate it well and you really use the data well in our day-to-day practice. So he talked a lot about AI algorithms and how we might be able to use those types of AI algorithms to expedite clinical care, for example, in documentation or in looking at pattern recognition through scans, for example, for diagnostics. And then he also talked about the delivery of care in our health systems and how we need to also be cognizant, right, as we generate more and more of these algorithms, to be aware of how they affect our day-to-day practice. So he introduced a new word. I actually learned a new word called algorithmovigilance. And apparently it's a word that exists.
One word or two?
It's one word, algorithmovigilance. So it's a word that exists in the bioinformatics space of how they take algorithms and ensure that they are working for the people who are using them. So it was fascinating, and you know, artificial intelligence is coming right to our health systems, and it was really interesting to hear his thoughts about how it could be applied to kidney cancer field.
Yeah, people talk to me about AI from time to time. I don't understand it either, but I get the impression that some people say things a lot to me like, you know, we're going to be able to do digital pathology more accurately and read CT scans. But that's not really artificial intelligence. That's just applying algorithms. Artificial intelligence is more than application of algorithms. And pattern recognition, once you have the pattern, you just apply that pattern. And again, I'm not sure that's artificial intelligence. It's not like the papillary renal cancer is evolving. It is what it is. And once you have the pattern, you can use that system. How do you differentiate between this, or how did this individual differentiate between what is essentially complex algorithms and genuine artificial intelligence?
And I'm not an expert, right? But Dr. Mb's talk was really about, look, artificial intelligence is really about all the data that goes in and then having the computer process it so that it generates something new out of what was put in. So input in and output are not exactly the same. How that applies to diagnostics or on either imaging or pathology, I think his there was a takeaway figure of his that had the person's brain plus a computer is greater than the person's brain itself and is greater than a computer by itself. And so his key message, I thought, was really it takes both people and computer systems, and we have to be smart to drive that artificial intelligence to do what we want it to do.
Well, I think it's figuring out how to use it. As you say, it's coming in whatever form. And Tom, to your point, whether it's algorithms or true AI or somewhere in between, I mean, a lot of what we do is pattern recognition, right? Patient symptoms, pathology, CT scans. I mean, that's I feel like that's what we do for a living, even in drug development. So if we can not waste brain space doing what a computer can do, then presumably we can, make advances quicker. I think to me, that's where the real promise
Brian,
is.
Brian, let's get an AI podcast going. Maybe we could do two or three, a series of AI podcasts. It might be fabulous.
Great idea.
Tian, I saw on Twitter I wasn't at the meeting. I saw some Twitter activity around some data on a new VEGF TKI that Monty presented. Which I think is 94 or XL94.
92,
92, sorry.
Oh, 92, yes.
Yeah. What's the story with that?
So this new drug has a name now. It's called zanzalintinib. That one also rolls off the tongue really well. Zanza for short. But this is a new tyrosine kinase inhibitor inhibiting VEGF receptors, MET, and the TAM kinases, so TYRO3, AXL, and MER. It was tested first in a basket trial of sorts called STELLAR-001. And there was a particular cohort that was dedicated to clear cell kidney cancer, where everybody was treated with zanzalintinib, 100 milligrams a day. And the primary endpoint was around objective response rates. And what was really interesting of the 32 patients that they enrolled was about half of them had had prior cabozantinib exposure. And the majority had had one VEGF TKI prior, and also almost all had a prior immunotherapy. So in this cohort, the objective response rate for patients who had prior cabozantinib was about 24%. And if you added in the stable disease, about 90% stable disease or better.
And is it fair adding in stable disease in these professional patients who, third, fourth, fifth line renal cancer? Is stable disease a good result?
I think in refractory kidney cancer, right, obviously we'd love to shoot for a cure and complete response for anybody, but in refractory disease, there's sometimes where we're holding stable, and stable is good, right? And keeping the disease from growing is a good
Do all of our experimental drugs come out about 25% response rate in heavily pretreated patients? Is that a good result?
That's small single cohort phase two. There's a signal, right? Obviously, we'd love to see that replicated in larger cohorts that are randomized against our current standard of care. But I think you have to start somewhere, and starting in a population that is prior TKI exposed, that is IO exposed. I mean, this is a population that we all have in our clinics, and we're all the time thinking about what's new and what's coming down and how much we're able to help these patients with.
Brian, you were involved, Brian, with a drug called axitinib. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. I'm sorry if that's correctly. But axitinib, you tested that drug, that obscure drug, in this setting. And that axitinib was an experimental drug, and we just covered over the label. What would the response rate be in heavily treated patients, Brian?
Well, I think, just to back up, I think there was what I saw from Monty's data is that there's clear activity. I agree. I don't buy clinical benefit rate. I hate when it's reported because it's in essence a time to event endpoint in patients who must have indolent disease or they don't make it to third, fourth, fifth line. So I don't, I sort of discount that. But if you just ignore that and look at objective response rate, I mean, it's there's definite responses, right?
Now, so you love you love it, Brian. You love it.
Hold on, I'm not done. We've been burned before by shiny response rates in small selected cohorts. But there's clearly activity to this drug. The question is, how is it different than Cabo? Like biochemically, that's my question for you, Tian. How is it different? And then my other question, maybe for both of you, is, boy, it's hard to develop a new TKI in kidney cancer right now, right? That's a challenge. Even if it's quote unquote better or biochemically different, we can argue whether it is or isn't. But what's the path to turning this activity into a, you know, a registration study? So maybe, Tian, the first part to you about how is it different than Cabo biochemically?
Well, biochemically, it seems to have some effect on TYRO3 and MER, which, in addition to AXL and MET that and the VEGF receptors that cabozantinib hits, and also zanzalintinib has a shorter half-life. So the half-life of this molecule is about 19 hours instead of 99 hours of cabozantinib. So it's a little bit easier to use and a little bit easier to turn off. If you hit a toxicity, perhaps we can get a little bit easier washed out of the side effects, right?
Yeah, a little friendlier from a tox management standpoint. And you think, I mean, I know it's hard to say, but you think maybe the TAM kinase activity could account for some of its activity and could be an advantage.
I think so. And, maybe. And yeah. That's the only reason I can explain patients who I've had prior progression on cabozantinib going on zanzalintinib and having some responses.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, back in the day, maybe, Tian, this is maybe before you were born, we did like sunitinib rechallenge, right? And we definitely saw activity, right? People had been on sunitinib, went on something else, went back on sunitinib. So that's why I ask, you know, is it really that we're targeting different things, or is this going to be in the mix of other TKIs? And it's just too early to know. It's more of a hypothetical.
And I'm not as young as you think I am. we've used lots of sunitinib back in the day, but you know, the newer drugs as they're coming out, maybe they have some activity. But I agree with you that we need to see randomized cohorts. We need to see patients really tested and against current standard of care.
So maybe last question on this topic for both of you is, if you were given the task of developing Zanza in kidney cancer, what would you do? I know there's a papillary study ongoing. I'm not familiar with the whole program, but, you know, maybe it's different, maybe it's not, et cetera. I mean, all these vagaries, but how are you going to develop this drug?
I'm interested in the MER targeting. MER is not high on my radar. I always thought MER was one of the three gifts from the wise men at Christmas time.
I think we had a trivia question on that.
We should. I didn't realize that MER was one of these gifts from the wise men has now become a justified target in kidney cancer. I'm going to have to read a little bit about that. Look, what do I think about this? I think that it does have a bit of activity. I don't think it's outstanding. But I bet you if you put cabozantinib in the same space, it would have similar kind of response rates. I think it's great that people are continuing. I don't think it's harmful to continue to invest VEGF TKIs in this setting. And I don't think we've got all of the answers right. I disagree with Mike Atkins that it's, you know, these hypoxic inducing drugs are really bad for immune therapy, and therefore we should, you know, only give them late in the disease. I think they've got a really important role to play. I think some patients need these drugs up front. And I would like to see, I'd like to continue to see some of the new targets in combination with VEGF TKIs. I'd like to see LAG-3, I'd like to see TIGIT, I'd like to see personalized cancer vaccines. And I don't mind which VEGF TKI we use particularly. I think this has got a shorter half-life than cabozantinib, which is attractive, and it may have a slightly friendlier toxicity profile. I think many people like cabozantinib, and it's their go-to drug. I think it's going to be hard for this to displace it without, and I don't see head-to-head trials against cabozantinib. But am I pleased that that drug development is ongoing in kidney cancer in the hope of improving outcomes? Yeah, I think so. I'd love to see some biomarker work with it.
Sure. And I, you know, it was really interesting that Mike Atkins felt as strongly as he did. But to your point of developing this in context of the immunotherapies that we have available, the STELLAR-002 program is open. We are in the process of finalizing and opening at UT Southwestern, but and it is open.
What is that, Tian? I'm sorry.
It's also a basket trial across disease types, looking at zanzalintinib and combining, to Tom's point, with nivolumab and also with relatlimab, the LAG-3 monoclonal antibody. So it will have multiple cohorts, just like STELLAR-001. And so, you know, what's exciting is that this is sort of the foundation of single agent activity. We will eventually see the zanzalintinib in combination with PD-1, with LAG-3, maybe even TIGIT eventually. But there's a path forward, and we'll see what other disease types might be active. So it's not only in kidney cancer that we're having this, but for STELLAR-002, it also has cohorts with lung cancer and other solid tumor types.
There's a randomized trial in papillary. There's a randomized trial in papillary renal cancer too.
Correct.
Yes.
I think that's a pivotal registration randomized trial, and I think that's important too.
See, last question before, and then I want to hear about the other late breaking abstract before we finish. But in clear cell, let's say you had to design a registration trial for Zanza in clear cell right now, what would you do?
Oh, in clear cell.
Assume it's combinable with immune therapy. Assume there's activity. And you have to assume some data sets we don't have yet. But
right. I think, you know, combined with immunotherapy, we're really looking at those activity in the frontline setting. So could it go head to head with another? I don't know. I think it's probably easier to find activity in the refractory space and then slowly move it forward. I'm personally curious about the perioperative setting. We have several studies with TKIs of shorter half-lives added to immunotherapy. So I'd also be curious what the activity is in the pre-op setting, maybe for big bulky tumors or others where we really want some early control before we get to surgery.
I'd like to see LAG-3, and I'd like to see TIGIT triplets with new VEGF TKIs or old VEGF TKIs. So that's where I would go.
Tian, what else was the late breaker? What was the other one?
You didn't sound very impressed with that, Brian.
I'm never really impressed with you, Tom. I'm constant, tell you that.
Constant,
I don't know. I mean, it's
constant
tough.
Discipline.
I guess, if I had to answer.
Dismissive would be an understatement.
I think I was trying to move us along. I think, testing it in a frontline IO TKI, that's really challenging, right? Because your control can't be TKI alone anymore. And so I think that path will struggle.
You go against ipi-nivo.
Presuming.
All risk, including good risk patients.
And you think you could win that?
I think you can beat ipi-nivo. Yeah, I do. I'm not
okay.
sure how
let's,
much.
Let's
I'm
save
not,
that.
I'm
let's
not
save that
sure
for
how
another
much.
Podcast. Let's
see. Yeah.
I think you could go against belzutifan in a refractory population, right?
I wouldn't do that. I'll go much earlier.
You think Zanza Nevo is going to beat ipi-nivo?
I'm just not sure I'd go against belzutifan right now. Like, you've got to. Why would you go against belzutifan? Why not go against
to get approved?
Do you think that's because belzutifan is the lowest bar, or do you think it's just because it's the latest shiniest drug, Brian? You're just looking at the latest shiny drug and you grab it.
It is a standard in the refractory setting.
Well, so is everolimus. Why not go with everolimus?
Well, because I think you can beat belzutifan, and it's a more relevant standard.
I think belzutifan, the trial's going to cost an extra $200 million if you buy the belzutifan.
Fine, it's going to cost even more than that in the frontline setting.
Oh, yeah, but if you get frontline, you change frontline cancer, that's much more useful to patients than another fifth or sixth line drug. You can agree on that.
You think Zanza plus PD-1 is going to change frontline renal cancer? You're going to go on record.
I didn't say plus PD-1. I said we need to explore new targets with other immune checkpoints, including TIGIT and LAG-3. And that's a very different question.
Okay, but the question was, what registration trial would you do?
I think I would do. Okay, here we go. We've got ipi-nivo. I put that as my control arm. I would put PD-1 with a LAG-3. or TIGIT, and I would stick it in with a VEGF TKI, which why
you're
not
gonna
use
give
this
a quadruplet.
I've been on the call for hours. I know, Freddie. I know. Okay, Freddie. I know.
Right, let's
I know.
Move on.
Even Freddie's a bit bored. Freddie, I'm in 2 minutes. I'm coming downstairs.
Tian, the other late breaker was what? Let's finish with this.
Sure. The other late breaking was a study called Cassiope, and it was a prospective observational type of study with patients treated with cabozantinib and also radiotherapy concomitantly. And so in those patients, it was really showing that this approach of concurrent cabozantinib with radiation is safe. And these patients, most of them had prior radiation, palliative radiation, and they didn't see any new safety signals. So if we're going to use cabozantinib in the refractory setting and patients need some radiation, I think this adds to our information and knowledge that this is generally a safe practice.
Do you generally, if you have a patient getting palliative radiation to whatever organ site, do you generally stop TKI during? I mean, I tend to stop it a little bit, you know, but not a lot, but that's a completely arbitrary practice. I'm just wondering what you do.
Yeah, I think that's tailored to each person. But I do, and our radiation docs like to have at least a little bit of a washout. With cabozantinib, you know, with a very long half-life, you know, I generally shoot for about a week or 2 weeks in our practice before their radiation. But, you know, after their radiation, I will start pretty quickly after they finish.
I say don't give it on the day of radiation, and which is very different from that. I'm not totally bought into this concept of you can't give VEGF-TKI and radiation therapy together. I don't know where it came from. I think it's all anecdotal right at the start. I remember people saying, well, your mucositis gets a lot worse. I'm not sure if I've seen that. And I've had lots of patients who have continued for various reasons on VEGF-TKI through radiation therapy. It doesn't seem to have made any difference. So I don't think it's any harm in stopping. And we talk about treatment breaks all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm totally relaxed about stopping. We tend to do it. But I'm certainly, maybe
I think
the
it's
day
a
before.
Theoretical risk, right, of potential wound healing problems. And so if it's radiation and there's not a lot of dose to the skin or, an open wound, maybe it's a less of a problem than if it was pretty close to the surface.
Yeah, I think it just shows we all do different things and there aren't great data, right? I tend to stop for a short period of time, maybe 2 or 3 days. But again, it's probably something I did once and it worked. And so I didn't rethink it. But I think it's all over the map. But it's always good to have data. And I don't know if there's a difference between TKIs. Obviously, if you're stopping based on half life, then you're giving patients a much longer break with Cabo and the like. But more data to come, I suppose. But Tian, anything else to wrap up? First of all, congrats, great conference. A lot of new stuff. It's always hard to innovate in conferences.
Brian, we didn't talk about individuals who won awards.
Oh yes, let's wrap up with that. So I know Nizar
won an award. I can see that. I was on Twitter there. I was very supportive and encouraged.
Won the first Nick Vogelzang Humanitarian Award. Pablos Masal won the Rising Star Award, I believe.
If I could, Dr. Tanir won the second Nicholas Vogelzang Award.
Yeah, correct.
The first was given posthumously to Dr. Vogelzang last
Fabulous.
Year.
Fabulous.
Yeah. So, but it was a really wonderful acceptance from Dr. Tanir. He's obviously had a wonderful patient-facing journey and career. And so there was not a dry eye in the room when he gave his acceptance speech. And then Pablos Masal won the Christopher G. Wood Rising Star Award. Pablos, has these brilliant thoughts about statistics. So he gave a really nice statistics lesson after. and then Alex Kudakov, who's professor and chair at Fox Chase Cancer Center. He won the Andrew C. Novick Award for a career really distinguished in urologic research. So those three were highlighted. If you don't mind, I'd also like to talk about that bench to bedside story that we put together, sure. The panel of belzutifan. You know, this is something that we don't get to highlight a lot, a drug that goes all the way from bench side to bedside within a dozen years or so. We put together a panel. Bruce Posner was talking about the preclinical story of belzutifan and really thinking about how the HIF-2 alpha structure was distinguished, the PASB domain in particular, where these HIF-2 alpha inhibitors sit and block the dimerization. And then Eric Yonash talked about the initial IND package and early clinical development, how they developed the drug in von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. And across, you know, even in kidney cancer and also for extrarenal hemangioblastomas, for example, they saw activity. And then we had an FDA representative, Dr. Jalay Fala, who talked about how they looked at the data in aggregate. There's actually one indication, the retinal hemangiomas, that they didn't approve belzutifan for, but across the others, it was approved for treatment of von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. And so that was a fascinating discussion from her. And then we wrapped up with a discussion on reflections of that drug development pathway from the commercial side. So we had Dr. Naseem Zajwala, who was the first physician hired at Peloton Therapeutics back when this was PT2977, and how they really thought about the pathway from early clinical development of a pretty active, now approved, HIF-2 alpha inhibitor. And she gave a really cool trivia, Brian, you'll like this, that the first person dosed with belzutifan was in Nashville. The first patient on trial. Yeah, Sarah Cannon. So there you go.
Tian, a couple of questions for you. So we gave the prostate cancer folks at our Euromigos meeting a pretty hard time with the PSMAfore study, where they didn't have survival. We felt they didn't use the best control arm. Okay. There was an agreement that had they included chemotherapy as well as NHA, the control arm probably would have performed a bit better. And yet the hazard ratio was, you know, there was no survival signal. Hazard ratio actually was above, it wasn't above one. The confidence interval straddled one. But then we in the renal cancer community are very happy to trumpet our huge success with belzutifan based off PFS. Ours was 0.75, PSMAfore was 0.45, again, without OS. Has this story been a great success, or is this just a drug that was unable to beat everolimus, which none of us were really using anyway?
So
negative, Tom.
It's not negative. It's not negative. It's just we gave the prostate cancer folks a hard time, and I just want to make sure that we're playing on a balanced field. Like, I'm very happy to hear your positive line on this in the second bracket.
LightSpark 05 was the registrational pathway for it, right? And you have to say that the primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and so the hazard ratio did meet its predefined. But to the controversy is everolimus truly a standard of what we currently use as a single agent? And if you talk to a lot of our counterparts and a lot of patients, probably not, right? So yes, it was a lower bar to set. But I would be curious, you know, there is that crossing of the progression-free survival curves, and I'm personally curious as to which patients are the ones that respond, because when they respond, and if they respond, they have really nice responses and they can be quite durable. And so I don't know that, you know, it certainly was set up to beat a lower performing control cohort, but at the same time, it has activity in a subset of patients. I'm very curious about biomarkers to figure out who those patients are.
Tian, it's taken me 25 minutes to prompt or poke Brian into into controversy. So, Brian, just let me know what your take is on this. We made obviously in our Euromigos meeting, there's a whole podcast on it if you're interested. Brian, just tell me why you think actually belzutifan is active and justifies being used as a standard of care.
Well, I don't think there's any question it's active, right? I think we've known that for a while, right? That it has response rates in a refractory Agreed. Setting that Agreed. Are very TKI-like.
And justified, and justified as a standard of care.
Okay, well, if you let me finish, I'll get there. It has a PFS that is very TKI-like in a refractory setting. And I think what really makes it, right, is the fact that its tolerability profile is better than any TKI. If Belzu was another TKI that had a lot of toxicity, I don't think we'd be excited about it. Even if it had the exact same data as 005, we'd say, oh, all right, who cares? Another TKI and it's toxic and we don't like these and da-da-da, but it doesn't. Right. And so I think, as you well know, Tom, sometimes you're doing studies to get a drug approved to show it has activity so that you can further develop it. Right.
And yeah, and this is my take on it. I mean, I think I agree. I agree. I'm going to ask you a last question. It's difficult in a minute, but I agree with that. I think it shows clear activity. I think that the response and particularly the durability of the response and the shape of that Kaplan-Meier curve is really promising. And I think maybe early in disease, we can make a big difference. If you're given a choice, Brian, and you showed a provocative slide at our meeting comparing data with tivozanib and belzutifan, if the patient hadn't had those two drugs, but let's say they were a fourth line patient, which would you reach for?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't thought it through entirely. We put Tian on the spot in our meeting. I think the TKIs are going to have an earlier onset. So as you know, in that refractory setting, sometimes patients really don't need an immediate response, right? They're those professional patients. They have indolent disease. They've kind of just clicking off through therapy 1, 2, 3, 4. In that case, a lower toxicity with perhaps a later onset of action like Belzu would be a good choice. And you know they could be on it for a while, hopefully with long-term tolerance. If you need a quicker response, if the patient's more symptomatic, I think probably I'd reach for TiVo. We don't have time to respond with TiVo, but you assume it's quicker with the TKI. So I think, you know, until and unless we have a true biomarker, we're going to sort of have these clinical decisions. And I think I'd like to change.
I think I'd go to belzutifan. Tian, what about you? Fourth or fifth line, various VEGF TKIs before nivolumab as well. Are you going to change to a belzutifan or just give another VEGF TKI?
I might, especially if they have somewhat indolent progression on prior TKIs and seem VEGF loss driven and HIF driven. It's nice to switch out a mechanism, particularly for a drug that's well tolerated. And so I might switch it out for a little bit and then bring back tivozanib or some other in the latter lines. It's hard to say. Or if they've tolerated prior TKIs previously, maybe use tivozanib first, then look at belzutifan. But I think there's a role for each of these novel treatments in the refractory space. And I'm just glad that we do have all of these options to reach for our patients.
I think what'll be interesting, hold on, Tom, is we don't know how the label's going to be, but it did allow second-line treatment. And you can imagine for an IOTKI failure, you might be really tempted to use Belzu second line, especially if the patient's beat up from their TKI.
You'd right? do that rather to axipembro, cabo. You'd give belzutifan instead of cabo.
Well, I don't know. I think you'd be you might be tempted to do it if you had a more indolent progression patient.
Interesting.
Right. I think the label's going to allow it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I would do it routinely or I know exactly, but I'm just saying like I think you can see. If you had this sort of really indolent progression in somebody who was beat up from TKI, you might say, hey, let's see if I can get away with Belzu. And they respond and they do well for a while before I subject them to, you know, another more toxic TKI. Remembering that we're not curing anybody once we move away from immune therapy, in my opinion. So the sequence may not matter. You may make that decision based on tolerance.
Interesting. I probably think it's more third line or fourth line.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, and I'd probably choose cabazitaxel in front of belzutifan. And I think it's when it comes to, you know, that, you know, axitinib versus tivozanib versus belzutifan versus everolimus discussion. I think that is where I'd be going for belzutifan. This has been magic, Tian. Anything else we missed?
No, I think we covered it all, but we were so excited and it was really a a heartwarming conference in kidney cancer. So I hope your listeners, if they have a chance to join IKCS next year, they consider it. And it's in November of 2024 in Louisville, Kentucky. So we hope to see more of the kidney cancer community there.
Thanks, Tian,
fabulous job organizing the meeting. Really difficult thing to do, and it must have been a huge amount of work. It looked like it was fantastic. I wasn't there. I regret not being there, and I hope I'm going to be there next year.
I think it was better that you weren't there, Tom.
I think some of these meetings are better when I'm not there. I agree with that.
Thanks, Tian. You all know conference planning with your amigos the prior week, so it's great fun, and thanks so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Tian. Bye-bye.